This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 10th of October, 2015, on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Daniel Giacopelli, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs, broadcasted right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily, and of course, The 10. Coming up on the show, we'll look at Syrian refugees in Brazil, the life and times of the king of Scandinavian thrillers, the future of the LA Times, presidential politics in Nigeria, and much, much more. That's coming up in the next half hour, right here on The Recap with me, Daniel Giacopelli. We begin the show in Rio, where in recent months, images of thousands of migrants and refugees making their way by sea and land into Europe have been blasted across the media. Of course, many have chosen to venture elsewhere besides Europe. Brazil, for instance, has opened its doors to Syrian refugees, taking in more refugees than any other country in Latin America. Monocle's Rio correspondent Chyna Rossiter visited a family of Syrian refugees who now call the city home to see what their lives are like living in South America's largest nation.
It's lunchtime here in Rio de Janeiro's Botafogo neighborhood, and many passersby are stopping to get a snack at a roadside kiosk set up in front of a Catholic church. With the Syrian flag draped over the front of it, these three brothers, who are refugees from Syria, are selling traditional Syrian snacks, falafel, kibbeh, and esfiha, as a way to earn a living.
Most of my relatives, like, or friends, either went out of the country or dead. I have pretty much nobody left. We had to get the hell out of there.
That's 25-year-old Armin Nashawati, the eldest brother, who's been in Brazil for the past 2 years. As the conflict in Syria escalated, him and his family lost everything. In neighboring Copacabana at his apartment where he lives with his family and where they've been staying free of charge thanks to the generosity of one Brazilian family, they work 20 hours a day cooking food overnight, which they will then sell the next day. He explains why him and his family ended up in Brazil.
I just managed to get out with my brother eventually, and after that I stayed in Lebanon for a while and looking for solution. I didn't manage to get any solution, especially for the embassies, a lot of embassies, like Europe or Canada, Australia, and even United States. I like knocked a lot of doors and I wasn't accepted. I was like rejected. And then I heard a rumor from a friend. He said that Brazil is open and Brazil could receive any Syrian and help him. So I said, why not?
Brazil, of course, wasn't his first choice. He just needed a new country for a second chance.
We had to go. We had no choice. I was planning to go as far as I can. And after I heard this rumor, I went to the Brazilian embassy and you just talked to the woman. She was really nice. She asked me to stay. I stayed an hour or something for her. Then she took me to the consulate and explained everything to me. And she said, you'll be accepted. You don't have to worry about anything. But the problem that Brazil don't really support you financially and don't really give you a place like to stay and stuff. I didn't care about this because I needed an exit. I need to get out anywhere. And I need a new chance.
23-year-old lawyer Bruna Santos has helped some of the 20 refugees staying here at the Catholic Church in Botafogo get registered at the federal police station here in Rio de Janeiro. A bureaucratic process which can be challenging, especially if you don't speak Portuguese.
Brazil has the doors opened naturally. Brazilian people are very welcoming. We all know that Brazil isn't doing great these days. We have to pay a lot of taxes, but we're still doing our part of the job. We're sharing what we have. I've seen many people involved in helping those in need. So I think it's also cool how Brazilians are dealing with this situation. People ask me from time to time what to do in order to help those in need. We are all the same and in the same situation, which is this humanity crisis. And we must help each other out.
An estimated 350,000 migrants have crossed through EU borders between January and August of this year alone. But with border crossings becoming more guarded, and with some nations struggling to keep up with the influx of new arrivals, the idea of making Brazil their new home might become a more popular idea with some migrants and refugees.
I have to say that life in Brazil is adorable, it's amazing. I really love the people, love the culture, love the atmosphere of the country. It's really very similar to my country. It's warm, I don't have to worry about a lot of things. But still, economical, it's really, really hard. That's the only and the most important we have, the most serious problem we have. I really love this country. I only wish that I can receive some help from somebody serious like the government. But still, the situation is kind of okay.
For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
This week, Sweden mourned the loss of writer and playwright Henning Mankell. A leading figure of the Nordic noir genre, his crime novels explored the darker side of Sweden, providing an alternative view to the country's relatively crime-free image. Writer and journalist Barry Farshaw, who's also the author of the book Nordic Noir, shared his memories of his dear friend Henning Mankell with Monocle's Tig Enright.
The last conversation we had, and I found that whenever I met him, we would talk about death. Mortality would always somehow come up, and he was, of course, the son-in-law of Ingmar Bergman, who famously has a character in The Seventh Seal having a chess game with death. So death was a part of his life. And he had a kind of fatalistic attitude to it, but it was important to him that he did these things which involved social commitment, which involved making disadvantaged people's lives better. That was as important to him as any writing he did. The one that always strikes me most is the fact that I learned that he was on the blockade, on the flotilla that was attempting to break the Gaza blockade. And he, at one point, he had a machine gun trained on him by one of the Israeli soldiers. I asked him at the time when this was happening. In fact, I told various newspapers who didn't seem particularly interested in the story, which struck me as very odd. Major writer is being held at gunpoint. And he told me that on the ship, it was pointed out to the soldier, this was an important writer, and it would probably be a mistake if a gun accidentally went off. He was quite proud of doing that and doing something he felt was socially useful. He was very much for the Palestinians and for breaking the blockade. On the other hand, he realized that after this event, which did then become a story, he could never do it again because he had become the story.
His life was kind of surrounded by artistic greatness as well, and the fact that his father-in-law was Ingmar Bergman, the film director. What did they talk about, I wonder?
Bergman had a private cinema, which he built, a 17-seat private cinema. And apparently Henning told me that he and his father-in-law would sit watching films in this cinema, just the two of them. And he said that they were among the best times of his life, not just watching these films with Bergman, one of the world's great directors, certainly the greatest of all Swedish directors, but the discussions they had after. So I said to him, well, I assume this is The Seventh Seal and Fellini and serious art house movies. He said, no, it was George Clooney in Ocean's 11. And you've got this idea of these two very serious Swedish artists watching entertainment movies together and chatting about it. So it wasn't all sort of doerness with him.
You say that he did talk a lot about mortality. I mean, how did he cope with his illness?
When I last saw him, it was not common knowledge, but he mentioned that he was ill. I think there was that sense often in such cases of someone settling his accounts. The sense that I got most from him was frustration because he felt there was so much else to do. He ran theatre companies in Africa. He did a lot that really was sort of off the radar in terms of being socially helpful to people. He wanted to do that. He felt that he had achieved as a writer the kind of success he wanted. In fact, he was thought of in a lot of foreign countries, not as a crime writer, but just as a serious novelist. So he didn't feel he had anything to prove then. But he said to me that before the Grim Reaper came calling, he wanted to do more for people. And he didn't say this in any kind of self-aggrandizing, self-righteous way. He was genuinely a man of humanity.
That was journalist and author Barry Farshaw speaking to Monocle's Tig Enright on Tuesday's edition of The Globalist. It's time now for a highlight from Midori House. Did the U.S. military commit a war crime when it bombed a hospital in the Afghan city of Kunduz? Médecins Sans Frontières, the aid agency which ran the hospital, has called for an independent investigation. Well, on Wednesday, Steve Bloomfield spoke with journalist Tim Marshall and Raffaella Pantucci from RUSI to hear their views on the situation.
It's clearly a human catastrophe what's happened, and it's a disaster that this MSF hospital was hit and these people were killed, and clearly there was a huge balls up, quite frankly, in terms of the communications. And I think the legalities of it are all very interesting and important. But in some ways, there's another interesting aspect to this story that we haven't really touched upon, which is the fact that the air capacity that the United States is able to provide to the Afghan National Army is said to be one of the key components that the Afghans say they really need and they're going to not get if the Americans sort of pull out. But it's very clear that in response to the air capacity being tracked back, the Taliban have started to mass in larger forces. You start to see large sort of takeover and large sort of attacks. So as a result, we are seeing there's a very interesting sort of question here about, you know, the air capacity is clearly very important, but in this particular situation, it's clearly been used in an incorrect fashion. And yet at the same time, it's clearly one of the key components the Afghans keep saying that they need. And I think that in some ways is the longer term ramifications of this story, which I would wonder a bit about.
There is also a fundamental issue here, Tim, isn't there? In the US needs to explain what they're still doing in Afghanistan right now.
I think the answer is they're saving face. I mean, Obama, with his coherent foreign policy, gave the Taliban a start and an end date. Oh, don't worry, we'll be gone by then. I'm pretty sure now the Americans will leave a larger force behind than they had planned to.
I think it's a question of what ambition was set and the wildly unrealistic sort of realities which are sort of portrayed, that we're going to create some sort of Switzerland in Central Asia.
Not
you know?
Originally, but sorry.
Well, I mean, it did come in very quickly. You're right. Initially, the idea was we're going to get rid of the Taliban, we'll get rid of Al-Qaeda, move on to one world, right? But in reality, then after a while, the conclusion was, well, no, we need to sort of create institutions, we need to build the peace. You
and
know?
Some of that did come from a good place, sort of didn't it?
Oh, it's all well-intentioned, but you know, in reality, how are you going to create this? You've got to create a whole set of cultural institutions which take a long time. There's a reason they're cultural institutions. It takes years for these sorts of institutions to develop, for practices which, frankly, people have survived on for a very long time to prosper and succeed. So it takes a long time to sort of develop the kind of community that we have, for example, and the sort of civil structures that we have in the West. It takes a long time for those things to develop and for them to be expected to be developing in the wilds of Afghanistan with the sort of lack of infrastructure that you have, with the sort of differing tribal cultures and communities. Frankly, fake borders that you have in a lot of these parts of the world, which is sort of doodled on a map by someone sitting in the Foreign Office here. You know, you're dealing with a reality there which is wildly different to the one that you're sort of operating from here. So to expect the sort of institutions we have here to just naturally pop up there is very difficult to imagine. Having said all of that, I think it's always important to remember that you do have levels of education in Afghanistan which are much higher than you had before. You do have internet penetration, you do have women going to school, you do have a whole set of things that have changed. So I think to say that it's been a total disaster is incorrect. But I think to say that what maybe people had thought was the bar of what we were going for has been, frankly, written off as wildly unrealistic. Now the question is, what is it we're going to end up with and how can we preserve that?
And there's a broader issue here about how the local forces on the ground will try to use the military might of their Western partner, not necessarily in the way that those Western partners will want. I'm thinking in particular in Yemen when Ali Abdullah Saleh would call in drone strikes on people he said he swore were Al-Qaeda, but actually just turned out to be his political opponents.
The Americans get hideously embarrassed. I do believe they are genuinely contrite having done this, but I don't think the Afghan forces would have any compunction about calling in if, and we this is not yet proven, if they were being fired upon from the hospital grounds. They'd have no compunction about calling that in. And but on the wider issue, there's a problem of discipline. Many, many developing countries' armies, the officer class runs away, abandons their soldiers. We saw that in Iraq. And then you also have this lack of comms. NATO itself has a communication problem. I remember all the way back in the Kosovo War, the Americans ended up not bothering to talk to anybody else because the Dutch were saying this and the Brits were saying that and the Americans were saying this. And not all the kit was even on the same wavelength. So the Americans just went literally on different frequencies, unable to connect. Now, magnify that with the Afghans. You know, they're not trained how to communicate with the fast jets that are flying over them. And so it all becomes secondhand, and then you get mistake after mistake and tragedy after tragedy.
Monocle's Steve Bloomfield there with Tim Marshall and Raffaella Pantucci on Wednesday's edition of Midori House. Up next, a bit of media drama in the US. Stay tuned.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted right here at Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. The Los Angeles Times was founded by two families, the Otises and the Chandlers, and they used the paper to campaign for the development that turned LA into the huge city it's become. But the paper they founded is shrinking. It's not just that sales are falling. There used to be 1,200 journalists at the LA Times newsroom. That number has more than halved, and the paper's publisher, Tribune, is now offering generous terms to encourage more staffers to leave. On Wednesday's edition of the Monocle Daily, Emma Nelson and Paul Osborne caught up with Ken Doctor from Politico, who's been writing about the problems of the LA Times.
We're now into 7 years of no revenue growth for U.S. dailies, and really serial cutting of jobs. We are just approaching the point, probably within a year, 18 months, where American newsrooms will have half the number of journalists that they had at their peak 25 years ago. The LA Times is lucky in the sense, and you use the number 1,200, that was the height of the LA Times newsroom, but it is down to 500. That is still one of the top three or four largest newsrooms, newspaper newsrooms in the United States. But it does have that feeling of gloom and doom because it has had serial cuts, and it has had big questions about now who's going to be the owner and how long the current publisher is going to be in place.
You see this in newsrooms all around the world. They try to save money, and there is this thing, can you grow by cutting?
I think we have documentary evidence, and this is the field I cover, that the answer is no. They have tried that, and what they are essentially doing, but they'll never want to say it publicly, is managing decline. So these are all the Tribune papers and their fellow papers across the U.S., all profitable. They're all throwing off profits in a kind of 5 to 15% annual range. But the only way they're maintaining profits is this continued cutting. And we do see this downward spiral in product. I cannot think of another kind of company that would essentially be cutting its product in half, which is what they've done both in print and essentially what you see on the website and the apps, and double the price for it, which is what they've done. So if you bought a liter of Coke and imagine that it was now a half a liter and it was twice the price, how well is that going to work? But that's essentially what the newspaper industry has done here and in much of Europe. So it's not a recipe for growth and sustainability and really taking advantage of what digital uniquely does to bring all of us the news instantly. It is a recipe for simply taking profits in the short term and then trying to figure out how long these enterprises will be alive.
That was Emma Nelson and Paul Osborne with Ken Doctor from Politico on Wednesday's edition of the Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. Since the end of the Cold War, the European Union has grown gradually resigned to the idea that the leader of Germany is also, by default, more or less the leader of the continent. That assumption has been tested in recent months by Germany's widely disliked hard line against Greece and hardly more popular open door to refugees and migrants. The most obvious split in opinion about Germany's leadership is ironically almost exactly along the line which Germany straddled back when Europe was rather more obviously divided. Eastern European countries, despite having been kept out by a wall well within living memory, have been the most enthusiastic about putting them back up. Well, on Thursday, to learn more, Monocle's Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson were joined by author and broadcaster Michael Goldfarb.
She has had thrust upon her this position of leadership. It's been a Franco-German project, the EU, and what's happened is, because the French president, François Hollande, is domestically weak and perhaps doesn't project himself as well on the international stage as he might, Angela Merkel has become de facto the kind of leader, the leading voice in the European Union. But what happened in this meeting is, in the old Eastern Bloc countries, when the Soviet Union disintegrated and they suddenly became independent nation states and went through the accession process to join the European Union, it was as if the 19th century had not been worked through yet in places like Hungary and in what is now the Czech Republic and Slovakia. And a strong strand of nationalism emerged. And it's become a very popular political form, often led by people who were Communist Party apparatchiks anyway. So they do know how to be strongmen, and they know how to ride this tide. And if you go into the countryside, when East Germany was joined onto West Germany, it's taken a long time for East Germany to almost, but still not quite, catch up economically to West Germany. In Hungary, in Slovakia, these countries have not derived a great deal of benefit, or the same benefits that other countries have, from joining the EU. And when economic times are hard and people who are foreign come drifting through and you think, no, we don't want this. We can't even employ our own people. So you got this combination of like 19th century nationalism, stroke racist, semi-racist feeling, and you've got this economic reality, and it's created a hard line against hundreds of thousands, possibly, migrants, refugees coming out of Syria and up over the Mediterranean through Italy into these nations. One of the interesting things about Germany is that of all the countries that initiated the extraordinary violence of the mid-20th century or participated willingly, Germany has done the most to recant and to restructure its society. What's been interesting in the last 9 months is that when the Germans took such a hard line with Greece during its most recent debt crisis, they had pictures of Merkel on the wall, graffiti all over Greece of Merkel with a Hitler mustache. Now she's kind of the savior of these great masses of refugees coming out of Syria. Germany is de facto, in population terms and in economic terms, the biggest country in Europe. It is also assuming the mantle that it tried to assume through bloodshed, you know, for the best part of two centuries. It is the dominant power in Europe. It is prima inter pares.
In terms of domestic politics now, and there are indications that the brief flowering of sympathy for refugees occasioned by that ghastly photo of that poor Syrian kid is beginning to fade. How constrained is Germany by its history? Because it's not politically thinkable, is it, that a German government is going to order thousands of people to be put on trains and deported back to the East?
No, that's simply not going to happen. And I think that in some ways, Merkel has been smart politically and diplomatically even, because the problem isn't going to go away even if Europe erects fences at the border between Turkey and Greece. They're going to get to a point where they have to have a unified policy, because so long as the Syrian civil war continues, and it's a multi-sided civil war, and you've got millions of people displaced, Europe is the next spot on the planet where they're going to end up. And that too many Western leaders either posture or just duck. Here's a woman, the Chancellor of Germany, who stood up and said, look, this is what needs to be done. She has in private, or she thought it was in private, told the leaders of other countries, look, I'm one of you. I was from East Germany. I know what it's like to live on the wrong side of the barbed wire. And we cannot, having achieved what we've achieved through unity, we cannot turn our backs on the rest of the world and not help out. We have the strength to do it. We'll see if she can sell that.
That was Monocle's Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson with Michael Goldfarb on Thursday's edition of the Monocle Daily. And finally on the recap, we head to Nigeria. A political story has been quietly bubbling in the West African nation for the past few months, and in recent days has taken another turn. The country's president, Muhammadu Buhari, was elected in April of this year, but until this week, hadn't completed one of the major essentials of any governmental shakeup, naming his cabinet of ministers. Well, for an update on the story, Georgina Godwin was joined on Friday's episode of The Globalist by James Schneider, senior correspondent for New African Magazine, and also Tolu Ogunlezi, a Nigerian journalist based in Lagos.
He's generally taken extremely seriously. He's a serious person. He's a quite stern, disciplinarian man. So he was elected at the end of March, and he was announced the winner at the very beginning of April, and he was sworn in at the end of May. And he said that he would announce his cabinet list by the end of September. Now, quite a few people, myself included, thought that was a bit slow. They were expecting a bit more, but he's got a lot of goodwill because of his strong anti-corruption drive. And so people thought, yep, right, we'll wait for it. But the way this has so far has been announced hasn't been, in my opinion, brilliant. It's only 21 of the names, so they're going to be another 15. All that we've seen is their names were announced on the Senate floor along with their state, which is normal, but we don't know what position anyone is nominated for. There's still no idea of how this government's going to take shape. We still need to know who the other ones are. Then they still need to be vetted by the Senate. So really, it's now a year since Buhari became the candidate for the then opposition All Progressives Congress. So you would have thought around that time you start trying to work out what your government is going to be in power. And it's been 12 months and we're all guessing, we've all got intelligent guesses of who's going to get what job, but we still don't finally know what the form his government is going to take.
Now, Tolu, are there any surprises in any of those names that have so far been announced?
Well, yes and no. It's a difficult one to answer, actually. There's some surprises in the sense that a lot of people have had to Google, you know, people that many of us had never heard of before. But in all of those names, you then find that there's connection or the other to Mr. Buhari, who started politics with him in 2002 when he joined partisan politics.
What's the gender balance like, Tolu? Are there many women?
No, there are not. There are only 3 women, 21 positions, which is 1 out of 7, which is less compared to what former President Jonathan did.
James, he was voted in on a promise of cutting down on corruption, but naming himself the Minister for Oil isn't exactly a promising start, is it?
No, that's actually the one thing that is a promising start on corruption. He's understood to be so ascetic and incorruptible himself, and the oil sector is so important. Also, the Petroleum Ministry and the National Oil Company, National Energy Company, have had so much terrible corruption, huge leakages. And so actually him controlling that one isn't a sign, I don't think, that he wants to kind of grab all the money, but perhaps stop other people grabbing all the money.
Right. Let's now turn to his trip to the United Nations, which seems just like it was an absolute fiasco. What happened there?
Not to be slightly snide, but if he had a foreign minister appointed, so the person who is likely to be his foreign minister was there. But I think part of the problem of having everything so concentrated around the presidency as it has been, and around all of the difficulties with protocol and so on and so forth, he can't be everywhere at the same time. And if he doesn't feel very well waking up one morning, that throws off everything because it's much more difficult to get people to substitute for him. So I think he was criticised for not being in a meeting where Boko Haram was discussed, and it's reported that he came in late when the Pope was addressing.
Through the wrong door.
So the wrong door thing, I mean, that can happen to anyone. That's a protocol mishap. Everyone's walked into a cupboard when they were trying to walk out of a room and it's all been terribly embarrassing. But I think the more important point is it does show the limits of this totally centralised presidency, and we do need to see ministers who are empowered to act very soon.
Georgina Godwin there with James Schneider and Tolu Ogunlesi. Well, that's all we've got time for in this week's episode of The Recap. This show is edited by Weidong Lin. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs right here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Daniel Giacopelli, thanks for listening. Goodbye.